Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I'm Joan Connolly. I'm a classical archaeologist and professor of art history and classics at New York University.
Wow. Doesn't that sound very Indiana? Indiana Jones. Okay, so please, we're here talking about The Parthenon Enigma, your latest book. And before we get to that, tell us a bit about your background as an archaeologist and a professor, etc.
Well, I have been working and excavating in the Greek world for over 30 years. I've excavated at Corinth and Nemea and worked at the Athenian Agora in Athens. I've also excavated and worked in Kuwait, where Alexander the Great's successors in the region built a fortress, which continued for 200 years throughout the Hellenistic period. But for the last 30 years, I've been focused on Cyprus for my field work, and for the last 25 years, I've been directing excavations on a small island off the west coast of Cyprus, which we believe has everything to do with Cleopatra and her rule on Cyprus.
Wow. I was always fascinated with archaeology myself because, you know, it's one of the few fields in academia where you're, you know, super active. You know, it's like action academia. You get to go in these incredible places, rich in history, and dig.
Yes, well, it is, as I tell my students, the one enterprise that occupies mind, body, soul. It is the physicality of archaeology. It's going into the lab. I consider the excavation trenches like a scientist going into the lab each season. I have a need to be there, a longing to be there, and that is where I test ideas and new evidence emerges and makes me change my ideas. And so it's a very good laboratory for learning to keep an open mind.
Very important.
Well, I do think that field archaeologists bring a certain something to their work that they have learned in the trenches, which is that you may work under one paradigm for a few seasons. You always have to have a working hypothesis of what's happening at your site. But each summer, with your own hands, you dig evidence that disproves your thoughts from last year. And you cannot deny it when you've dug it yourself. Mm. And so it keeps you humble. I think field archaeology teaches humility above all things. We don't get too attached to believing one thing and saying we're right, and it's not a competition for rightness. And so when we discover something that disproves what we thought last year, we have to let that paradigm drift off to sea. And
you
then we embrace
you can't sort
a new...
of hammer at it.
Exactly.
Know?
Yeah. Or force the evidence into proving you're right. Mm-hmm. And so when I come to something like the Parthenon, I'm coming at it as a field archaeologist that is humble about how little we really know, and nothing is written in stone, and no orthodox view is not to be challenged, because what we know is a mere fragment of what existed back then. And so perhaps I tell my students the most important tool we bring to our research is an open mind.
I think that's wonderful, because so frequently academics being removed from sort of that working model, when you challenge the ideas, you somehow challenge them. And you beautifully have to get out of your own way in that. And it allows you to really come at something we can't possibly know. We weren't there, you know, so we can't know. So we are
absolutely.
Just
absolutely. You have hit the nail on the head. And, you know, it's easy to imagine that if you're working from the comfort of the library and with certain papers in front of you, you begin. The world is quite small, and it seems set and firm, and not to be challenged. But maybe it's being out of doors. Maybe it's being in the wild, the trenches of Western Cyprus with the sea crashing of it. But it really does. For me, over 25 years, has been in this particular site. I know it better than anyone, I might say. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I am deeply aware of how little I know and how humbled I am. So I think that classical archaeology is such a thrilling field because when you are out there, you learn a lot about yourself, self-knowledge being very important. Does my brain give out first, or does my body give out first? You're being bombarded aesthetically in the most beautiful landscape. You're being bombarded linguistically because you're speaking Greek to the fishermen that bring us their laborers and the village. You're living this village life where we attend every baptism, every funeral, every wedding. We are part of a community in a way that, alas, the rest of my year is in New York City, which is quite the opposite, a city of transient people and friendships that come and go. But my village in Cyprus is where I grew up.
Wow.
And it's very compelling. You feel very alive when you're on an excavation.
Well, and also because you're living in that village, you can also almost fantasize you're living in that time that you're excavating as well. Is that how you got into this field? Was it a fantasy as a child? Or
I don't know that it was a fantasy. I grew up in a very I grew up in Ohio, in Toledo, Ohio. Not a great deal going on, but the only show in town was our great Toledo Museum of Art. And from age 4, my father would take me there every Saturday, and it was my playground. I would speak to the statues and speak to the paintings and run between galleries and make up stories. And I really fell in love with the Greek and Roman gallery and the Greek vases and the myths. And I'm still doing it. I mean, well, what is uncanny is that the mornings were spent at the museum and the afternoons, when not riding horses, were spent with my dad looking at construction sites because he was a civil engineer and a general contractor.
So was my dad.
No kidding. Well, then you know. So looking at looking down foundation mm-hmm. trenches, learning how buildings are put together and go up.
Wow.
Daddy taught me how to survey, how to use a theodolite as a little girl. And so archaeology is basically a combination of art and construction sites. The two things that I did every Saturday throughout my childhood, it's amazing how a few hours with Dad shape a life.
Yes. Wow, that's incredible. Okay, but that leads us perfectly to, before we get into the Parthenon, explain the importance of architecture, the role of architecture, sculpture, and plays. Because they think the story is really around those.
Yes, well, first of all, a great question, if I may say so, because try to imagine a world in which there is no media. There's no photography, there's no film, there's no internet, there's no nothing. So in a world like this, one cannot underestimate the impact of a monumental building with a monumental pediment gable with sculptures in it. So the visual was so much more heightened, so much more important, the impact of these monumental stone temples that are begun to be built largely in the early 6th century and throughout the 5th. These were the billboards onto which the community projected their identity. And above all, it projected the genealogy of where do I come from? Mm-hmm. And this is part of paideia, the Greek word for education. So a temple like the Parthenon, which was active as a place of worship for over 8 centuries, by having the great billboard of sculptural decoration showing eons of time layering backwards of who was my great-great-great-great-grandfather? Well, we're descendants of Athena. What was her birthday like? And so this creates a local identity, a local memory, and it sustains it over nearly 1,000 years, and it ensures that the mold is kept. What makes an Athenian citizen aware of his origins and her origins? So we cannot underestimate. These are not just buildings. These are messaging centers. Mm-hmm. They, of course, are gifts to Athena, but they are the receptacle of local memory, local identity, self-knowledge, and heavens, they did the job. They're still standing today.
Mm-hmm. RadioGorgeous.com.
What is the traditional or given understanding of the frieze that goes around the Parthenon?
Okay, since we have no ancient source, contemporary source that commented on the frieze and told us what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. We are in a position of looking at what what voices remain. There may have been voices, but they didn't get written down. So our first commentator on the frieze is Pausanias, writing the 2nd century AD during the Roman period. And he comments on the gables and on the statue of Athena, but he doesn't notice or comment on the frieze. So our first is Cyriacos of Ancona in the 15th century, 1444, writing letters, traveler, man of letters, merchant.
And this was before it was damaged.
Yes, exactly. 1674 is the big explosion. So 1444, it's more or less intact. Of course, there were interventions when it became a church and a mosque, but for the most part, it was in better shape then than thereafter. He wrote a letter saying that on the frieze we see the Athenian army in the day of Pericles. So this is very important because he's saying it is a contemporary 5th century event. It is a snapshot of reality and not a scene from myth. Mm-hmm. Then our next voice is 18th century. It's James Stewart Nicholas Rivette, the British traveler, amateur architect and artist, who drew it in the 1750s and whose publication in 1787 contained the gentle question they threw out, could this be the peplos of Athena, that is the dress of Athena, presented to her on her birthday festival each year, looking at the central scene above the door. They threw that out. Could this be the peplos? Could this be the Panathenaea? And over time, this gentle question hardened into established dogma, almost never challenged for the past 230 years. Now, it was a very good guess in their own day. They were learned men.
And it was a question, It was a question. It was a theory.
They didn't mean for it to not be looked at
discussed. Yeah.
So the trouble was this. All other Greek temples derive their subject matter of the sculptures from myth, not from reality. Mm-hmm. The notion, if I dare not call it a Periclean selfie, but the whole concept of selfies in the ancient world, there is even a train of thought coming out of the French school, which I quite like, that says the function of images was to show you what you can no longer see. You didn't need to see a snapshot of the present because your own eyes can take in the
present. Because
you
were in it, yes.
So this makes sense to me if you engage with an ancient way of thinking about the role of images. Images make a past present, and you don't need to do that to the present. Mm-hmm. It is a present. Mm-hmm. So, you see, the trouble was we never had a myth that fit the images. People did try. Chrysoula Carthera, a Greek archaeologist, she tried various myths, but they never quite fit. Mm-hmm. And so all that I have done here is associate, and we didn't have the myth because the myth that I suggest was not well known until the 1960s, and it takes a long time for new papyrological discoveries. We're referencing the discovery of this play by Euripides, which was produced 10 years after the completion of the Parthenon, that tells the story of Erechtheus, an early king of Athens, and how he sacrificed his virgin daughter to save the city. This was a big play. We knew about it because 100 years later, the orator Lycurgus quotes 50 lines of this play in a trial against Leocrates, and he's trying to discuss how to be the best kind of a citizen, how to be a patriot. And he says, look at what the daughters of Erechtheus did. This is how our forebears regarded the city. They loved it so much they gave their lives for it. And this 50-line quotation is the longest quote of any tragedy by any orator. So we knew, and he says, on these lines our ancestors were brought up. This is an important play, but we never had enough of it.
And where was the play?
Well, this is the thing. It's a magnificent story. And it shows how collaborative archaeology is, because the discovery was made by a French archaeologist in 1901, Pierre Jugay, working in the Fayum Oasis of Egypt. He excavated in 1901 and 1902 hundreds of mummies from the 3rd century BC that were held in coffins, that is, casings, not made of gold like the coffin of King Tut that we think of when we think of sarcophagi in Egypt, but made of the humbler material of papier-mâché, which is what your average men and women could afford. So these papier-mâché coffins were actually made of recycled paper from the recycle bin. So it's really very human when the scribes at Alexandria, who were charged with transcribing plays, this is how, no Xerox machines in those days. So what do? You have a team of scribes writing. Old Greek plays, Greek history, this is how they come down to us in the Hellenistic period. But invariably they would make errors in transcription and they would throw that sheet of papyrus into the recycle bin. And then that would be taken off to the morticians who would use the valuable commodity of paper to make mummy casings, gluing it together in papier-mâché. Who would guess?
Amazing. Which is what we do. You know, you take old newspapers.
Of course, yeah, that's what it is. It's astonishing. And then, therefore, these mummy casings become one of our best sources of lost texts.
Amazing.
And these were found in 1901, brought to Paris. They rested at the Institut de Papyrologie until 1963, when a method was derived of how to extract the pieces of paper from the glue that held them together. Mm-hmm. Now, by today's terms, this is considered a rather brutal method that André Bataille, the professor in Paris, put these casings in a steam bath of dilute hydrochloric acid and glycerin that would make it slippery and peel apart the levels.
Wow.
With today's technology, with laser scanning, we don't even need to break the case.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because that's sort of an archaeological choice. You know, do you preserve the casings or... Do you
right.
get at the texts?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, you're right on the money, because in the case of this particular papyrus that is so important for our understanding of the Parthenon, it's called Sorbonne Papyrus 2328. they did not boil or steam bath the entire mummy casing. They left the face because it was regarded as quite beautiful, the face of a woman gilded. And so I have, well... It has occurred to me that were we to investigate that face, perhaps we could get a little more text.
Right.
Now it's utterly random. They don't choose all the same play to go in the same mummy casing, but there's a chance that we could get more text of the Erechtheus, and I would love to do this sometime in the future. And with laser technology, we could certainly have a peek, if possible.
So this play, as you say, it was the most quoted, and it was seen as this is emblematic of how to be an Athenian. This is an Athenian's creation myth. This is an Athenian's, this is an ideal. This is like the Lincoln Memorial. Like, this is how to be an American. This is how to be an Athenian. And you think this is what this shows. And what does it say? Because it's considered, sorry to interrupt you, but sort of the birth of democracy. So what do you think its statement on democracy is?
Well, what is revolutionary about the Athenian system? There are so many things, but the messaging of the central scene over the door of the Parthenon is a scene in which the king and queen of Athens are sacrificing their youngest daughter to save the city. A barbarian horde is surrounding the Acropolis. The king, Erechtheus, goes to the Delphic oracle. How can I save my people? You must sacrifice your most precious thing, your youngest daughter. And so he asks his wife, what shall we do? And she makes, Queen Praxithea makes the most stirring and civic-minded speech in all of Greek tragedy, to my mind. She says, of course I give my daughter to save the populace. No one family, not even the royals, not even the most elite people of the city, should put themselves above the collective good. And so what is revolutionary here, and I do believe it is a central tenet that makes the democratic system different from others, and here I'm really building on the work of Danielle Allen, a political theorist and classicist in the United States, who has written so beautifully about the centrality of sacrifice to the success of democracy. The notion here is that everyone, every citizen is called upon to be willing to make that ultimate sacrifice, including the 1%, including the top layer, that against the contemporary days in the Greek world where you have the Persian royal family running from the battlefield at Salamis, saving themselves while their huge fleet is destroyed. Of course, the royals would always live and rush away and go back to Persepolis and continue on. But what they're putting above the doors, no, not at Athens, because democracy requires all of us being willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And you have to trust the system that if you lose in one case, let's say in a public policy vote, you lose, but you have faith in the system that the next time the chips will fall in your favor. Mm-hmm. And you have faith in the system that I might be sacrificing on this occasion, but one of my fellow citizens is going to sacrifice for me down the road. And the whole system requires this understanding, and you buy into it as a faith. And I even make the case that for the ancient Athenians, democracy was a kind of religion, something unthinkable today where we live with separation of church and state so rigidly. But when it is a system of faith and trust and sacrifice, we are really approaching something that we could almost call a kind of religion. Mm-hmm. And this is what enabled it to survive for 200 years or so, because it's the leap of faith.
Yeah, and that's very different from how democracy purports to work now.
Well, absolutely. And modern democracies are not trying to mirror the ancient democratic system. Of course, many modern democracies and the law look much more to Republican Rome than they do to the democracy of 5th century Athens. Mm. But and modern democracy, of course, is more inclusive, i.e. women, slaves, foreigners. Yes. So, so to be sure, our challenges are many, and whenever you are trying to reconcile the great welter of individual interests and factions, and the whole struggle of modern democracy is the balance between a citizen's obligations to the community and the community's responsibilities towards the citizen. Yeah. But it is worth pausing, not to say we can adopt an ancient democracy, but it is worth reflecting that perhaps we've lost some sight of collective good above all.
Yes, and our responsibility towards this, you know, what we consider a right, but our responsibility toward it and the requirement of our participation and our belief in it in order for it to work.
Exactly. That it does require a leap of faith, and people are skeptics today and not willing to perhaps do that. And I would just add that, you know, what's so fascinating to me about the Athenian system, when you think of private law today, it is all derived from Rome. Mm. The Athenians did not have private law. Again, the idea of the collective good was so out there. So much of our difficulty,
it was in the fiber of people.
So not even to develop a legal system of private law, but it was really, they lived this collective good notion to the letter. So that our laws are based out of Rome. So it's magnificent in a way. I mean, it's radical democracy. And imagine also, you know, a huge percentage of elected offices, maybe as much as 80-90%, were drawn out of a hat. Lottery, sortition, all the eligible candidates just pull the name out. Imagine if we adopted a system like this.
And you had to live with this person, and this person had to live with you.
Yes.
And in this role.
Yes.
Fantastic. Anybody could be called. So you had to act right.
You had to act right. You'd hold the office for a year or whatever the term was, and then you would pass it on to someone else. And also, I mean, when you think today in the States, how much we spend on elections, winning elections, the obscene amount of money that goes in, you have to wonder, well, are we better off than if we just pulled the name out of the hat?
Exactly.
Use that money for something else. But it also made everybody be civically engaged and aware and at the ready in a way that, you know.
Yeah, we tend not to be.
Not to be.
Well, and it's funny that you say that, because that private law aspect hadn't occurred to me. And when I think of the Oresteia, it was a civic trial, because it was the warring gods that they had, you know, what you were supposed to do, the different gods. Well, don't kill your mother because the Furies be after you, but, you know, but yes. Apollo's telling you to kill your mother because she, you know, she killed your father, and that, you know, and the young gods right. versus the old gods, and the, you know, so it was chaos because of the gods, not because of the people.
Right. Well, I will tell you, and also this ties back in with my reading of the Parthenon in general, is that because we do not have religion at the forefront in our lives, have tended to look at the Parthenon through the political lens, through mm-hmm. democracy, civic, symbol, icon, architecture, aesthetics. But first and foremost, it is a sacred space. And that we tend to think of the Athenians in a romantic way as these, philosophers, rationalists, spending their day in luminous contemplation of truth and beauty and science and art and architecture. And to a point they were doing that, but even those people, those intellectuals, were deeply religious, God-fearing, spirit-fearing. The whole landscape was full of divine presence. They spent much of their day asking and thanking and trying to keep things right with the gods. It was, I mean, the whole point of the Parthenon, it's a giant temple to honor Athena, to thank her, to keep her on your side,
yes.
to ask thanks.
Keep her nice, keep her sweet.
Exactly. And so what we have to engage in, if we engage with a dark myth of virgin sacrifice, which seems so dark to us, but is really emblematic of a willingness to put collective good above self, we see a beauty, and it's a metaphor for the revolutionary nature of the society. But we must never lose sight of the fact of religion permeating. The Greeks didn't even have a separate word for religion, because there was no facet of life that lacked a religious aspect.
Yeah.
That was just plain life. And so I think we are at a disadvantage today because religion is something put on one side and so separate from civic life that we can't recognize it in the Athenians and their experience.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous.
Okay, so now, speaking of the separation of the frieze itself. And very famously, the Elgin Marbles are here in London. There are some at the Parthenon themselves, so those are the majority of them. But they're also in about five or six other places as well. So one, how did you, when you, your reading of the play, and then you have to, you know, physically go and see and do your research. What is your thoughts on, okay, so the play was found by a French man in Egypt and taken to France and then dismantled. And that, you know, I mean, this gets very complicated. What are your, and then political. And of course, because there's a financial component to it as well, which motivates things. What are your thoughts on all that sticky stuff? Sticky, undiplomatic stuff.
Well, if you look at the structure of the book I have written, you will see chapters 1 through 8, my reading through the ancient eyes, through the lens of those of the time that built and received it, and going down to the Pergamene princes and how they were influenced by the Parthenon and building their Pergamene altar. That book, that stands as its own as a book. I have a very slim foreword and afterword, a prologue and an epilogue, in which I touch on the issues that you have raised, and I quite conscientiously do this separate from the core of the book, because this is not a book about the return of the Elgin Marbles or Parthenon sculptures. But I have added the prologue and epilogue as asides, and because you cannot write a book on the Parthenon today
and
not mention
that.
The elephant in the room.
Yes.
And so I do try to bring a fresh take on it, and I offer some fresh views. Of course, someone who I have woken up every morning for the last 25 years thinking about the Parthenon before I put my shoes on. I mean, if you eat, drink, and sleep it, and you really are with it, of course you come to a different understanding of these issues than someone that thinks of it, when they happen to land in London, and it's nice to know
that they're
there.
Yeah.
But I really do, and so of course I understand that my perspective is not going to be that of everyone, and these are issues in which people change their minds. So I really offer some gentle, different thoughts on this. I try to make the case, I don't try to make the case. I mean, just the result of all of this work is that you understand the Parthenon sculptures as very interconnected with one another. They were not made as independently movable objets d'art or mobilier in the legal term. They are part of a building, and a building that still stands to this day in Athens. And they derive their immediate meaning from their relationship to one another. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, my reading shows that it is all about genealogical succession myth, one generation after another, after another, after another. And if you engage with this paradigm, you will see, for example, that on the west pediment we have the river god Cephissus in the far left-hand corner. And this is the river god who has a daughter, a naiad nymph, who goes on to marry King Erechtheus. This is Queen Praxithea, and they are on the frieze.
Wow.
So you see, you get generation of father, daughter, husband, granddaughters, and
it's a family tree.
It's a family
as well.
Tree. Yeah. It is a, and then on the west pediment you get Athena fighting Poseidon, and it's Poseidon's son Eumolpus that comes to fight Athena's son, nursling Erechtheus. So again, you have it's a generational thing, and you cannot really. It's urgent that they derive this collective meaning by being proximate to one another.
Exactly, in proximity to
each
other.
I also think, for my own self, you ask a great question about, of course, archaeologists do deal with fragments and then have to try to create a context in which they can see it as a whole in order to come to a deeper understanding of what they're looking at. And I do think that one of the reasons that the frieze has perhaps been misread for so long is that, first of all, it is not shown as a continuous narrative, which is what it is. It is instead, as displayed in the Duveen Gallery, it's inside out, for starters. Mm. It doesn't wrap around the building. As the installation in the New Acropolis Museum that is in readiness for it would have it as it is located on the temple as you walk around it. And secondly, even the division of chopping up with doorways and entryways, it's like fragmented. And so I do think that that affects a reading, and it affects viewing, affects reading. And so I do hope that in my lifetime I can see them together, because I think it will change research and it will change what people see and understand. You know, what I say in the epilogue very, very briefly, just a paragraph or two, is that, of course, these questions, so I'm not asked these questions by audiences in the United States. They really are not focused on this issue at all.
Interesting.
But there is a sense in the States that legal frameworks only get you so far. International laws are wonderful, but they also have their limits. And so people are embracing an ethical framework and bypassing the legal framework altogether and saying, okay, legally, this cannot be done. But ethically, let's just do the right thing. Mm. So many people are giving objects back, uniting objects. And what this does is has opened in the States a wonderful revolving door of exchanges. And American audiences are being really delighted by a never-ending rotation of objects coming from Italy, coming from other nations that enliven the permanent collection in a way. And this is what globalization is meant to be good for.
Yes.
Exchange.
That's what we were sold.
Well, yeah.
Not just spying on us, you know.
Exactly.
Sharing.
Sharing. And when you share objects, you also share personnel, and you can train people, and you can co-author catalogs together.
And you share perspective.
Exactly.
And you gain understanding.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I'm quite hopeful and optimistic. I do think I've been teaching, I teach maybe 300 young people a year, and the next generations coming up see things very differently. And I think this will be a no-brainer.
Professor Connolly, amazing. Really exciting. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for being so generous with your time.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I hope that your listeners will buy the Parthenon Enigma and read it and enjoy it and give it to their friends, because I wrote it for all of them.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?